It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Back in September, we learned that the number of birds in the United States and Canada has fallen by 29% since 1970. There are 2.9 billion fewer birds today than there were 50 years ago. At the same time, there are a few species, some pretty special ones, that have seen their numbers increase dramatically in the past 20 years or so, including two species beloved in Iowa, bald eagles and trumpeter swans. This hour, we're going to talk about Iowa's birds, the pressures they face, why some species seem to be thriving, and also how you can see birds. Jim Pease is here. He is a wildlife biologist and emeritus associate professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being here today.
And you bet.
We do want to start with that study that was released back in September. The numbers are really stunning and frightening. When you look at that study, what do you think is the most important thing to understand?
Well, I think it's important to think about that sort of loss of 29% of the birds. That's really impressive. But a lot of people, I think most of us won't notice it because we're not necessarily looking at the birds that have been lost the most. And it includes birds, especially grassland birds. They were the heaviest hit in grassland bird category. And this is a grassland state primarily, an old prairie state. And certainly in the Midwest here, these are the grasslands. We're talking losses of an excess of 50%. 50%. So it's really pretty severe. And of course, that means that it's certainly related to habitat. It's certainly related to pesticides. It's most certainly related to the combination of human expansion in the use of the landscapes here in the Midwest. All these things kind of have come together. And like many of these losses, you know, it's gradual enough over time. We don't necessarily experience it. And the study was based on this combination of citizen science, amateur ornithologists that the whole field of ornithology has depended on for many, many, many years. The more eyes you have in the field, especially experienced eyes, the better the data is. And along with professional ornithologists, confirming the sightings or the non-sightings and the numbers, especially. So this is a long-term study, and it really, I think, it shocked everyone. And so it's grassland birds and then boreal forest birds, those forests in the northern part of the U.S. Here in the Midwest, we're thinking about northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, northern Michigan, and across Canada, the southern part of Canada is where the boreal forest. Those were the two groups of birds, and those boreal forest birds most of them, in fact, are migratory. And so this study is based on those 500 or so species that were looked at, and most of them being migratory from the grasslands and the boreal forest, some up into the tundra as well. But these are really impressive numbers of losses. And lots of people have had this sort of nagging feeling, boy, I'm not seeing as many as I did when I was younger in many of these categories. And it includes things like warblers and many of the smaller birds that the vast majority of people probably don't watch for.
Well, and the language of the study really brings to mind what Rachel Carson was writing about in 1962 with Silent Spring, the fact that when you wake up in the morning, you don't hear the kind of bird song that you used to hear. Now, a lot of us probably don't remember the kind of bird song that she was lamenting, you know, not hearing.
Right.
But it's striking that this study looks back to 1970. Of course, she published her book in 1962.
Right.
A lot of changes were made after that to make less of an impact on the environment. And some species have made incredible comebacks. And we'll talk about some of those species in a little while. But if we take a longer look, the losses just continued from when she was concerned about it.
Yeah, that's for sure. And that Silent Spring idea It refers to things that we are aware of. Certainly, let's think about bluebirds, that song of the bluebird, of meadowlarks, of bobwhite quail, of thrushes. Those are the songs of our childhood, or my childhood, that we'd hear in the early morning. And those of us who pay attention to these things, it's like, oh yeah, I remember that. And we're not hearing them. I've had lots of people say to me over the years, what's happened to the meadowlarks? Well, we saw, sort of blips and increases in the population when the Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, was brought in. And we looked at some of the grass, because those created in Iowa 2.1 million acres of grassland, essentially. And it provided habitat for some of those grassland birds. So we saw little upticks in their population briefly, but as the acreages of CRP got reduced over time with new farm bills as they came along, or changes in government policy, those gains were quickly lost. And people that say, "Well, gee, I did see more meadowlarks for a few years there, but now they're not around anymore." And those sort of random observations are confirmed, I think, by the study. Grassland birds are the ones, and boreal forest birds are the ones that are experiencing the greatest losses. And while we have done some things, certainly since the 1960s when Rachel Carson's book was written, some things haven't changed. We've changed, for example, the chlorinated hydrocarbons that she was talking about, especially DDT and similar pesticides. We've certainly changed the kinds of pesticides we're using. The kinds we're using, though, now are often more lethal and more effective at and impacting insect or nematode populations. And that, in turn, because they affect those populations, it also affects the bird populations that eat them. In fact, there are lots of entomologists, those who study insects worldwide, that are noticing dramatic declines in insects concomitant with this decline in birds.
So we're seeing less acres of natural grassland
right. In
Iowa. Mm-hmm. But throughout North America, as the human population climbs, habitat is being destroyed really everywhere. I mean, that's part of this equation, right?
Yes, exactly. Certainly habitat losses, pesticide use, habitat losses, more and more land that is put out there for human uses and the kinds of things that we want to do, and less wild land available.
I want to shift and talk about some of these species that we have seen reappear, because it has been very, very exciting. I know for me, it's personally very exciting, but I also... It can possibly create a false sense of security among Iowans as well.
That's...
But, I want to talk about eagles because, when I was growing up, I was 12 years old before I ever saw a bald eagle. I grew up in Iowa. I had to go for a beautiful long hike along the Mississippi River, and I saw an eagle far away. And now I drive to work across the Iowa River, and literally there are so many bald eagles that I cannot count them.
It is amazing. It's such a wonderful sight, and you're one of those that notices. Not everyone notices, of course, but you're fortunate, I think, and we're fortunate to have you who notices and talks about these things to the public, because that helps the rest of the public begin to look themselves and say, oh, gee, those are eagles along the river. Instead of just staring at the highway, they notice these things along the roadside. And I think you're right. It may give us a false sense of security. I talk with lots of groups of people still, even though I'm no longer Extension Wildlife Specialist, and I still do lots of talks around the state. And often I talk with kids, and kids say to me, well, gee, what's the big deal? I see eagles all the time. And I said, it wasn't always that way. I remember a time when I was a youngster growing up in southeastern Iowa, right on the Mississippi River, where we would see eagles, of course, only in the winter time, and many fewer than there are now, many, many fewer than there are now. In fact, my brother and I had a kind of a blind made into a bunch of a log jam sort of beside the river south of Burlington on a place called Sullivan's Slough. And we would go down there, climb into the blind in the early morning and watch eagles. This was right below where the local, the Iowa Southern Utilities Company had a cooling tower that would empty water back into the river, and it kept the ice out of that area in the wintertime. And of course, that's what the eagles were coming down to fish in that open water. And all we saw, and this is in the 1960s, all we saw were adult bald eagles. It didn't occur to me, of course, at the time why we were only seeing adults, because I didn't know that eagles, it takes about 5 years before a juvenile bald eagle gets that full white head and full white tail. Why were we not seeing juveniles? Because in those years, when DDT was rampant and being used widely across the United States and Canada and Mexico and lots of other places, that's when DDT was impacting the eagle populations by removing the calcium from their eggs, unbeknownst. It was being studied, but it was thought to be not as big a problem as it became. And the recruitment into the eagle population was the eagle populations were crashing as a result.
Because so there were just no young eagles.
Young weren't being brought into the population.
All right. So, we're going to take a short break, Jim. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about bird populations around North America and Iowa today, and we'd love to hear from you as well. Tell us what you're seeing or what you're not seeing. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. With me, Jim Pease, wildlife biologist and emeritus associate professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour, wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we're talking about birds today. We've talked about the pressures that birds all over North America are facing and the information that we have that shows that populations are declining dramatically. And also, we're talking about some of the birds that have made really impressive comebacks in Iowa and elsewhere in recent years. You're welcome to join the conversation with your observations and questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, before the break, we were talking about bald eagles. And the really incredible thing is not only that we get to see bald eagles along the rivers in Iowa in the winter, but we also have a really significant nesting population in the state now, too, which was non-existent when you were a child and when
yeah,
I was a child.
Right. There were none nesting in the state of Iowa when I grew up in the 60s. And in 1972, we made a very difficult, politically, socially, medically, a very difficult decision as a society, and we banned the use of DDT. We didn't ban its manufacture and export, but we did ban its use. So we'll give ourselves that much credit. And it was not an easy decision. It was a very difficult decision. And it was amazing. By the late 70s, we had the first recorded bald eagle nest in the state of Iowa in about 1978 or 79, I don't remember which, and it was along the Mississippi River. And I thought, gee, that's wonderful. Eagles are responding rather quickly to the banning of DDT use in the U.S., and that's just terrific. But eagles are so wild, and Iowa is so tame, we'll probably only have, maybe half a dozen nests. And that'll be along the Mississippi, maybe one or two along the Missouri. And I thought, as a young biologist, I thought that it would never recover any farther than that. boy, was I wrong. Eagles are much more resilient than most of us thought they were. And we today now have not only the thousands of eagles that overwinter in Iowa, but we have over 400 nests, eagles' nests, in the state of Iowa. And it's not just along those two border rivers, but on all of our interior rivers, all up and down, many of them in urban areas. There's one in downtown Des Moines, right next to one of the major parks. It's pretty amazing how much more tolerant of humans they have either become or were, and we didn't think they were. But we gave them a chance by making a very difficult societal decision about DDT.
Well, and we
and
can't
they responded,
you know? We can't really compare the population today to the population before DDT, can we?
Well, in what sense do you mean?
Like, if we can't know how far the population has bounced back compared to what the population was before
human
started.
Settlement.
Right.
Okay. No, we can't, because those are pure guesstimates. But certainly they are as good as perhaps as they were. The only way we have of doing that is looking at very anecdotal sightings that are recorded by various explorers from Lewis and Clark, et cetera, et cetera, and we can look at some of those. But those are anecdotal. So no, we really can't. In Iowa now, we actually do every year have for now, I think, close to 20 years, maybe more than that. We've done these annual counts. There are routes all over the state that are driven by, I think there are 50-some routes around the state of Iowa that are driven by folks who observe and count eagle populations. And those really vary from year to year. For example, several years ago, we counted over 4,000 eagles on those overwintering eagles in January in those various places. But that was in a particularly cold winter. Last year, we had fewer than, I think it was right around 3,000 that were counted. Why the difference? Well, last year we had a lot of open water, so the eagles were all spread out up and down the river. In really cold winters, where the rivers will freeze over and most of the lakes freeze over, it's only below the dams or at those places where they're kept open by warmer water coming in, like I was describing when I was a child. It's only in those places that we see concentrations of eagles. Like, for example, in Iowa City, below the dam, right in downtown Iowa City.
Right smack dab in the center of town.
Yeah.
It's pretty exciting.
And the river is open then all the way, for quite a way south now. Is it open, a mile south of?
At least. I would say, okay. Well, I don't know where it's frozen. I guess I can't tell you that. But
okay.
All the way, I would say at least 2 or 3 miles south of downtown Iowa City, you have the open water. But they tend to congregate a little bit farther north. So really right in the center of town.
It's
and
amazing.
In Coralville, right along the river as well. That's where people can really gather and see them. They're close to the reservoir.
Sure.
There are just flocks and flocks of eagles. It's
amazing.
Incredible.
Yeah, the same thing in central Iowa, below the Sailorville Dam, below the Red Rock Dam. It's amazing. Along our major rivers, along the Mississippi. And that's why in January and February there are eagle watches put on by county conservation boards, by the DNR, and other folks that are fascinated by these birds. They're all over the state, and so I encourage our listeners to go take advantage of those, because it is an amazing thing to see 50 eagles sitting in trees in front of you. It still amazes me.
And explain to your children. Explain to your children why it's so amazing. I did. My kids are on board now, but there was a brief period right after we moved back to Iowa. So it was, 2010, 2011, and I would get so excited every time I'd see eagles. And one of my kids said, "Mom, why is this such a big deal?"
Yeah.
And I told them, I said, when I was growing up, I didn't think my children would ever see an eagle.
Exactly.
And now you guys get to see them every day. So
right.
They get excited now, too, which
That's
is
good.
Kind
of You don't
them.
Get the eye rolls anymore.
I get a few eye rolls. I have a 14-year-old, Jim.
Okay. You definitely get the eye rolls.
Exactly. All right. We're going to talk about some of the other species that we're seeing a lot of, some great ways to get out and see different bird species as well. You are welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. And since we are on the subject of raptors, let's go to Rick on the line in Ames. Hi, Rick.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, we're having our own silent spring in the wintertime here. We don't have any birds. The juncos came back and disappeared. The sparrows are gone. We've always had cardinals here coming to the feeder. Nothing, not even woodpeckers. I did hear a nuthatch down the block. I did find a clutch of sparrows about a half a mile away from here. And we think that a Cooper's hawk has moved into the neighborhood because we're seeing this raptor a lot. It came after the cardinal's nests in the summertime, and it was very aggressive, and we would even be trying to scare it away from the tree and hardly able to even deter the darn bird. Does this sound like a real thing, Jim? And if so, we just have to let nature take its course and we're not going to see songbirds anymore?
Well, I think what happens, and I've gotten calls like this over lots of years, Rick, and in fact, there are often local conditions, very local conditions, like a Cooper's hawk in your neighborhood, or like neighbors who let their cats out all the time. When predators are around, birds are more cautious. They are more likely to move around more, and rather than stay in one place at your feeders like they maybe did at one time. And like most predators, if they're not getting fed, in other words, if there aren't birds around, and this is a Cooper's hawk is a fairly large hawk that captures other birds. And when you put out bird feeders, it does, you know, you're feeding that bird as well. It's one of the problems when we concentrate wildlife, like around feeders, we have the chance of attracting predators that feed on those birds as well. But after a while, the Cooper's hawk will move on or move out, and hopefully then the birds will come back as long as the habitat is there. The problem is, as I say, very local. I don't necessarily think that this reflects, although reduced numbers of birds on Christmas bird counts, for example, may reflect some of what the study that we talked about earlier in the hour showed, this reduction of 29% of birds in North America in the last 50 years. But the kind of conditions you're describing are pretty common, and usually they're short lived. The bird, once it stops finding prey, will go elsewhere, may come to my feeders. So, and I've had a Cooper's that has hung around my feeders, and the birds learn very quickly to head for cover. So you got to have lots of cover around for them to get into.
Rick, does that answer your question?
Yeah. What's the territory for a bird? I've seen this. It's probably the same bird as far away as a half a mile from here.
Yeah, that wouldn't be unusual at all. And it may not be the same bird. There may be other, other Cooper's hawks.
Right. They're very similar looking.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And Sharpshin is a smaller version. That also eats birds, but they'll hang around for a while, and then they'll move on and move to areas that are more productive for them. The problem with cats, you have to concentrate on that human communication with your human neighbors and encourage them to keep their cats inside, not let them roam around outdoors where they do, in fact, they will sit below feeders or in feeders sometimes and pick off birds as they come in. So, yeah.
Rick, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And I want to talk about waterfowl, but I want to specifically talk about trumpeter swans, because that's another species that we've really seen make an incredible comeback in Iowa. Although waterfowl in general seem to be doing better than, for example, grassland birds that we were talking about before.
At least currently, they are. And waterfowl populations have historically kind of, they've been on the rebound for a long time. At the turn of the last century, in 1900, waterfowl populations had been so decimated by market hunting. And I hate to even call it by the term hunting. It was market harvest. It was take as many as you want.
Really slaughter.
Yeah, whenever you slaughter, exactly. Whenever you want, as many as you want, and at whatever age you want. And so there were waterfowl populations had just been decimated. So since that time, they recovered. And there are various efforts over the years, and those efforts of providing habitat, particularly in what's called the duck factory, which is the areas of the north central plains and north and south Dakota, Iowa, Minnesota, and across the prairie provinces of Canada, where the large numbers of species and ducks breed and then migrate south. Lots of efforts to restore wetlands and provide breeding habitat, et cetera, et cetera. And those at various times have shown, increases in the population. And certainly Ducks Unlimited and other conservation organizations have been as well as agencies, have been absolutely critical at making those populations recover. But trumpeter swans in particular, and I would add in pelicans, white pelicans, and a number of other aquatic species have come back largely through very specific efforts of both conservation organizations and public agencies that have worked really, really hard to not only provide the habitat, but to actually kind of speed up the process by reintroducing pairs of trumpeter swans back into wetland areas that they probably would use over time, but it often takes a long time for them to recover to the point where they would branch out and find new habitats. So the reintroduction efforts of these agencies and organizations have been absolutely critical to that recovery.
Well, and a lot of us who were in Iowa 25 years ago remember very clearly when pairs of trumpeter swans were put in place at various places around the state. They had their wings clipped so they couldn't leave to try to keep them there, to keep them on their nests so they'd start reproducing. And that has paid off extraordinary dividends. And Ames, Iowa is one of the best places to see trumpeter swans.
It sure
now,
is.
Tell us what you can see at Ada Hayden Park on the north side of Ames.
On the north side of Ames, there's an industrial area that was turned into a park. It used to be a gravel pit. It's called Ada Hayden Heritage Park. And where the gravel was removed are now two connected large lakes. And lots and lots of waterfowl use those lakes coming through, but we now have a lot of overwintering waterfowl that use them as well. And you say, well, don't lakes freeze? Yes, they do. But the numbers of Canada geese, which is another waterfowl species, which has finally recovered to the point where they're almost pests for if you're a golfer or trying to maintain the front of a corporate headquarters where you have thousands of geese coming in there. It's not such a nice thing, perhaps. But at Ada Hayden Park, the geese keep this section of the lake, unless it gets really bitter cold for several weeks at a time, they're able to keep a small part of the water open. And in recent years, trumpeter swans have joined them. And just this morning, coming into the station, I drive by Ada Hayden, and there were 50 or 60 of them at a quick count as I drove by. And there have been as many. I think one of our spotters the other day recorded 199 trumpeter swans, plus a few tundra swans, which are beginning to overwinter here as well. So it's pretty impressive to see that many big white birds. It's incredible just to see them.
And I suppose you get to hear them, too.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. That very distinctive trumpet as they take off is pretty spectacular.
We are going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We're talking about birds in Iowa and North America, and we'd love to hear your questions, your observations. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about birds in Iowa. With me, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He is Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. We've been talking about the pressures that have caused a dramatic decline in bird populations all over North America. We've also been talking about some of the species that we've seen really bounce back in Iowa and in North America, including bald eagles and trumpeter swans. We'd also love to hear your observations and your questions. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, first I need to ask, do you have a trumpeter swan impression that you do?
No, I don't.
Oh, bummer.
Sorry.
All right. And second, you know, when we see these huge bumps in population, like bald eagles, like trumpeter swans, where, you know, they have been huge success stories because right. of conservation efforts. And they're definitely things that we need to be proud of. But as I mentioned earlier, they can also be a little misleading.
Yeah.
So what do we need to bear in mind as we see these species come back? What is it? What's important that we don't take for granted?
Yeah. And I would add wild turkeys to the list too.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
And pelicans and they're all very big birds for one thing. So we see them readily on the landscape. Even those people who don't watch birds regularly, who might not notice the loss of meadowlarks or some warblers or Baltimore Orioles even, but they will notice these large birds on the landscape, and that's the troubling part of it. We'll see the big things, but we miss all the little ones that are really better indicators of our overall losses in the total environment. So that's the thing we'll take for granted. And I absolutely celebrate the recovery of these birds. But we must keep in mind, and we must continue to tell the story of how they came back. And it's taken huge efforts on the parts of wildlife biologists, on the parts of school children. I mean, a lot of around Iowa, there were school children that gathered together money and had bake sales and sold T-shirts and all kinds of things to bring a pair of trumpeter swans to a lake in their area. Those kinds of efforts are wonderful at galvanizing the human population to see what's going on around them. But we have to look beyond the big things to the little things as well. And it's studies like this that we talked about earlier in the hour that are absolutely critical for keeping us aware that, oh, gee, it's not just the big things around us. It is the little things as well, those things that sing and make those spring mornings that Rachel Carson wrote about so important.
We have an email from Bill in Sac City, and he says, what I've seen over the years is not just a decrease in CRP grassland acres, but a decrease in the quality of many areas that have not been reinvigorated with the periodic use of prairie fire. Mm-hmm. Over time, the non-native brome grass takes over. Then many of the contracts are renewed for another 10 or 15 years of low plant diversity. The diversity is necessary for healthy bird habitat. Those contract renewals exacerbate the increasingly low quality of the grasslands. The USDA Natural Resource Conservation needs to rethink their management of those CRP acres. So that's an interesting take on it. A lot more people on private land are trying to create a native grassland environment. People are doing that in their yards. And while we see CRP acres going up and down, I mean, looking at the quality of those acres, that does seem important as far as habitat renewal, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, my mind went in about 15 different ways.
We could do another hour about that.
Yeah, exactly. Because what's called mid-contract management is required for people with CRP acres. They have to partway through, and I believe it's, I don't know what the rules are right now. It used to be that there were two mid-contract managements for a 10-year period. You would do, there were certain things you had to do every year, but then partway through you'd do some disturbance of that prairie using fire or disturbance of some sort to renew exactly what Bill was talking about there. You get this better mix of species rather than, particularly if brome is coming in, which is a non-native grass, to renew that sort of the prairie species that were originally planted there. And what's happened over the years is that the enforcement of all sorts of contracts, not just CRP contracts, has become more and more difficult because NRCS has just like DNR at the state level, has fewer and fewer people as they've been, the funding has been cut from conservation programs on the national level and on the state level. As that funding gets cut, there are fewer people in the world, in the field to do the work of checking to make sure that those contracts are enforced. So that's the reality that we deal with, the political reality that we deal with, especially today, that landowners who want to make sure that that CRP is doing what it should and providing the kind of quality habitat, do that anyway. They'll burn those acres. They'll use chisel plowing or some disking to disturb part of it, and again bring in a greater variety of species and return it to the kind of diverse prairie that we once had here.
Here's an email from Greg in Story City. He said, here in Story City, our backyard has seen a significant decline in bird activity. We have hanging and platform and ground feeding with black oil sunflower and finch feed mix, also an electric heated dog bowl waterer.
Mm-hmm.
And this has all been in place for years. By now, we should have gone through about 60 pounds of feed, not even 20 yet. He says, the most obvious bird missing is the starling, not that we don't cuss at them when they mob the feeders. Also, starlings are not native species. Sparrow and house finch mobs are down as well. Few juncos. Perhaps because of this, the downy woodpeckers and red bellies are more active. One pair of blue jays. So definitely seeing some changes there.
Some decline. And that does happen from year to year. Again, we need to look across. If you look at Christmas bird counts, and that's exactly one of the sources of data that the study that we looked at declines in birds depends on, is those kinds of citizen science and ornithologists working together, and Christmas bird counts are one of those counts, and we noticed this year, for example, in Ames count that I participated in, it was wonderful weather. It's so dependent upon weather. We had no snow. It was the middle of December. It was a 40-degree day and kind of blustery, but it's still. And it was, as we went across the area that I was working on with another fellow, we saw relatively few species, and the species we saw were down in numbers. Now, That's what we recorded, and so that's what we turned in. Now, on a colder day with snow cover on the ground, would we have seen more? Probably. Would they be back up to what they were, 50 years ago? No, probably not. But there's a lot of variation, individual variation from year to year, from specific location to specific location. So you have to not take what you're seeing necessarily on your local backyard basis and generalize it to the whole population. Certainly, there may be some other things going on in Greg's neighborhood or in his in the general area that are impacting populations. We talked about earlier with Rick from Ames about a Cooper's hawk or neighborhood cats. That sort of thing might be one, but he may be seeing this larger. He may be looking at habitat changes in the area. Maybe there's a new development going in that has removed all of the brush in an area and the grassland in another. So you have to take into account all those things in the area.
Let's go to the phones now. Steve is on the line in Bettendorf. Hi, Steve.
Yes, good morning, Jim and Charity. I just want to tell you about a story my grandmother told me. She was raised in Morning Sun, Iowa, and as a child at the turn of the last century, she would hear the prairie chickens and they're drumming and they're mating, and that's not that long ago.
Yeah.
Now let's look at the 600-pound gorilla in the room, and we see the advent of the agrochemical companies, and I've seen it in my lifetime, and farmers taking out all their fence rows and spraying, cutting down hedgerows to get another acre out of those acres to get $3 a bushel corn. And with that, we're seeing a massive decline and extinction of many of our grassland birds and filling in of the wetlands. Let's look and see that, and human activity. And I don't know when it's going to stop, but just hearing my grandmother and now looking ahead at this next century and my grandchildren, it looks bleak. And until the ag practices change, and until we relish our wetlands and our grasslands and stop bulldozing every acre and draining and spraying, it's not going to stop. I wish it would, but it's not going to. And wake up. Ag is king in Iowa, let's face it, and it's not going to end.
Yeah,
thanks a lot for your call.
Steve, I think you've got a really good point. And certainly we've seen massive changes in the landscape of Iowa, beginning with Earl Butz, who was National Secretary of Ag, and his in the 1970s, and his encouragement saying, we're going to feed the world, so plow fence row to fence row, and you're right. We've seen, in addition, the change in farm equipment so that those becomes larger and larger, the fields become larger and larger, the fence rows are removed. And we've gone from, in the 1960s and early 1970s, from a state that was mixed agriculture with most farms had some form of livestock, had some hay, had some pasture, in addition to some row crops, to an agriculture that is primarily a row crop economy, and our livestock is now in confinement. And there are lots of reasons for that, and whatever. It certainly has made a massive change in the landscape. And certainly the farming methods have increasingly involved lots more agricultural chemicals.
And not all farmers. There have been other changes, the use of prairie strips.
Absolutely.
And there are many farmers that practice good practices that try to reduce the amount of soil loss, to reduce the amount of water runoff that they have. So I just want to make sure that we're not demonizing all the farmers in Iowa.
Absolutely.
However,
absolutely,
there have been these changes that have dramatically impacted habitat.
Yeah, if we look at on a statewide basis, we've had massive changes in our landscape in the last 50 years, and not just here in Iowa, but in you know, across the agricultural midsection of the country. The massive agricultural changes that certainly have negatively affected habitat. And human uses of the landscape, as Steve mentioned, rapid urban expansion, et cetera, et cetera. So there are lots of things that have happened on our landscape. And what we've tried to talk about today is what are some of the positives. In addition, we started with this report about the loss of 29% of the birds, which is perfectly believable and ought to be that wake up call to us. It ought to help us to help our legislators, for example, to say, wow, we really need to fund this piece of legislation, this constitutional amendment that Iowans passed by an overwhelming majority in 2010, and we haven't funded it for the last 10 years. The Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund. And there's a proposal by the governor to fund that this year. But she wants to change and I hope the legislators will say, take this and other evidence that we have in front of us and say, boy, we've got to wake up and we got to fly right here if we're going to have an environment and a place for other critters with whom we share this earth to live. And we've got to have a livable landscape, not only for them, but for us as well.
Now, Jim, we're nearly out of time, but I mentioned earlier that there have been a lot of individuals who are trying to create pollinator habitat or maybe bird habitat in their yards. And there is some evidence that you can make a difference. Even if you live in a subdivision with lots of Kentucky bluegrass, you can make a difference if you're willing to create habitat, right?
Right, absolutely. And there are all kinds of programs out there. Some by NGOs, the National Wildlife Federation has backyard habitat programs. Locally, garden clubs try to create habitat for wildlife. All the conservation organizations, Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, the Isaac Walton League, they all have programs that will help landowners on a large scale and on a small scale create habitat that will positively impact the birds in your area. Some things as simple as planting some prairie species in your yard, in stopping your use of pesticides on your lawn and your flower garden, using other means to control the pests that you might have, putting in a backyard water source for wildlife. You know, making all those things possible, putting in a brush pile. It may not be legal in your town or city, but putting in a brush pile where those juncos can hide out in the winter and those white-throated sparrows. But making that a year-round sort of effort to, not just in the wintertime, but year-round effort to make sure that species have a place to live, other species have a place to live as well as humans.
And get out and see some eagles.
Absolutely.
Right now. Well, you can.
And some trumpeter swans.
Absolutely. Jim Pease, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jim Pease is a wildlife biologist and emeritus associate professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.